from the biggest little city in the world, this is Diplo Chats, where your global engagement begins with a chat. Presented by the Northern Nevada International Center, leading Nevada's global engagement. Hosting Diplo Chats, Manuel Mederos, and a guest co-host. Welcome to Diplo Chats Season 2. All right, ladies and gentlemen, welcome to Diplo Chats, our season number 2. And it's so amazing to be here with you. I'm Manuel Mederos, your language access specialist for the Northern Nevada International Center. I'm so happy you are listening to us. And many of you listened to us last season from all over the world. We actually determined that it was about 35 countries that listened to our conversations with our guests. And this season is going to be even more dynamic than last year. Now, it seems like the conversations that we're going to have this season might be connected to the real human connection we all have with each other. And you'll hear that throughout the season. Any feedback that you have, let me provide you our email address, DiploChats, remember it's with a Z, DiploChats at NN, as in Nancy, NancyIC.org. Again, I'm Manuel Mederos, and my co-host today, because what we're going to do this season is going to be very special. We're going to invite staff to actually co-host with me, which is pretty cool. My dear friend, Kevin Sung, he's actually super amazing, but he's very busy with his programs, and I wanted to respect his time that he's devoting to that. So instead of having him here, we actually decided to have staff co-host and help me do this program so that you can better get to know in a better, bigger way and deeper way, understand the functions and the people who are running NNIC, the behind the scenes people, the human connection that we're talking about. So let me introduce my guest co-host, Brandon. His name is Brandon, by the way. I gave it away. But Brandon Danny, he's actually a super cool guy. I want him to introduce himself, but he's actually a medical coordinator, and he's actually with our refugee resettlement program. And I want to invite Brandon to come on with me right now, and let's give him a big applause there. Oh, we have an audience. My goodness. Thank you, everyone. They are awake. They are awake. So, Brandon, how are you? And thank you for joining us, being here on Diplo Chats, and you are my co-host.
Yes, thank you so much, Manuel. Of course, I loved hearing you with Kevin last season, but I have to be completely honest, I'm quite glad that he's given me this opportunity this year to get the opportunity for not only myself, but all the other staff to do this podcast with you, get the opportunity to really show off NNIC, show all the amazing people that work here, and I couldn't be more excited to get the season started with you.
Well, I'm happy you're here. Now, let us get to know you just a tad here during this part. What's your role at NNIC? What's your function here?
Yeah, so my official title is the Preferred Communities Program Coordinator.
And that's an important title.
Yeah, no, it's a very big title. I'm very proud of my title. But yes, I work with the Preferred Communities Program Director, Dr. Dina El-Shabrawi, and we manage this program called the Preferred Communities Program, and it is for refugees who come into the resettlement program here at NNIC, and then we determine that they have ongoing needs past the initial 3 months that we do really intense social services for them. So these are for refugees most often who have serious medical conditions, which is why the role of medical coordinator and PC program coordinator often overlap.
Right.
But they also might be other serious needs such as language barriers. They're having, for whatever reason, extreme difficulty learning English, or access barriers, if for whatever reason they have very difficult time accessing employment, healthcare, housing. So any myriad of reasons why they might need ongoing intensive case management past those initial 3 months, Dean and I are identifying them, and then we are really trying to come up with action plans to get them to that point of self-sufficiency that really NNIC is so dedicated to all of our refugee clients achieving as soon as possible.
So what you're saying, you're not busy, right? You need more time. That's why you're in Diplo Chats.
Exactly. I just needed one more thing to do.
Cool. Well, you're a pretty amazing guy. I know you've been doing a lot of great, amazing changes here for us. And you mentioned Dr. Dina, and she's such an amazing person. And I hope she comes on at some point here on Diplo Chats so people get to know her. and she is so caring, loving. And it seems like that's the theme for all of our staff that are very dedicated, very loving, very caring. And that's why many of our families thrive in this community, because when they come here, their lives are upside down. They don't know where to go, what to do, who to talk to, who to connect with. And I think NNIC really creates a foundation with our families, correct?
It's very interesting because everyone thinks of refugee and global resettlement and international migration and these very big, broad terms. And this is what I'm so excited that this whole season is focused on human connection, because what you don't often get a chance to see is the real human lives that are impacted by these global trends, by international diplomacy gone wrong or just unexpected. And working at an organization like this, what's most important is that we see these people for who they are, for their individual situations, and we get the opportunity to treat them like individual humans and not the product of this system that they really don't have any direct control over. So
And you mentioned, you know, we have to treat them and take care of them like humans. And perhaps where they came from in their camps or whatever country, whatever origin they come from, they might not have been treated as kind as we do our best to do here at NNIC. Last question for you before we go to a break, and we have our guest waiting for us. And by the way, our guest is Miss Jessica Ear, and we'll be talking to her in just a moment. But last question for you, Brandon. What's your most favorite part of your work so far? I know that you just recently started, but what's really the spicy thing that you have gained so far with NNIC?
I mean, to call it spicy would probably not be the most appropriate adjective for this.
But I'm spicy, that's why I said that.
But no, my favorite part of working at NNIC thus far has been getting to spend time with the clients. I'm very lucky that I get the opportunity to go and be there with them right from the moment that they arrive. We're doing intake paperwork for hospitals. We're having these really vulnerable moments where we're talking about medical histories. We're talking about living situation histories. And I get to become friends with a lot of these people, despite the fact that there's a language barrier. I get to learn about these extremely diverse and unique experiences. And it's really opened my worldview up in ways that I could never have imagined, and in ways that I know will impact me for my entire life. So it's pretty
awesome. That's
my favorite part. Yeah.
Well, that music means that we're going to a break. Brandon, welcome to Diplo Chats. We welcome all of you listening all over the world, and wanted to remind you that our slogan for Diplo Chats is
your global engagement begins with a chat.
That's right. We'll be right back with Miss Jessica Ear. You'll get to know her in just a moment. We all know that communication gives you a sense of community. However, what happens when the person you want to communicate with does not understand you because there's a language barrier? Awkward! Oh, excuse me. Well, now, you don't have to worry about a situation like that ever occurring, because the Language Bank at the Northern Nevada International Center provides in-person interpretation services, as well as on-demand over-the-phone interpretation services in 200-plus languages, 15-plus languages using our video remote technology, and also, we provide document translation services. Visit our website to learn more, unr.edu/languagebank. Our language services are always confidential, high quality, and accessible. You may submit a translation or interpretation request directly from our website. Visit us today, unr.edu/languagebank. We are back on Diplo Chats. I get to sing sometimes, Brandon, and it's super fun. All right, everyone, we're back on Season 2, Episode 1 of Diplo Chats. Remember, Diplo Chats, where your global engagement begins with a chat. That's right. If you want to get to know us, head over to nnic.org, nnic.org, and get to know our organization. And obviously, this podcast is fueled by the Northern Nevada International Center. Again, I'm Manuel Mederos, and I'm being joined by my guest co-host today is Brandon Denny. He's
Hello, everybody.
Part of our organization, a very important component of our organization. And throughout the season, you'll get to meet many staff. Now, really quickly, I wanted to invite you to download, like, subscribe our podcast wherever you hear our podcast. We're all over the map, all over the globe, that is. And so make sure you actually go and download us and like us, because we like you and we love you, and that's why we're here. Now, all right, without much talking anymore, we're going to invite Miss Jessica Ear. And let me tell you really quickly about her. And I told you earlier when we started the show that the real theme of our season seems to be like it's going to be that human connection. And I wanted to invite Miss Jessica Ear, not only because she's amazing, she's actually part of our board and we'll talk to her about that. I wanted to introduce you to her. And Miss Jessica Ear has spent the last 30 years actually working and living in Asia. Her extensive experience ranges from the U.S. Diplomatic Corps, where she negotiated with governments to advocate political and humanitarian issues, to the Department of Defense, where she advised, taught, instructed U.S. and foreign military and civil leaders on human security in the Indo-Asian Pacific region. Now, with a legal background in international studies and human rights, Ms. Ear has not only worked with governments, but she has also assisted the United Nations, the private sector, and non-government organizations in various areas that aim to improve human lives and conditions. And hey, we're talking about human connections. This is a perfect fit. She's actually versed in international development, refugees policies and resettlement, humanitarian and crisis response and support. As a former refugee from Cambodia, Ms. Ear is dedicated to promoting global peace and security. She learned English as a third language and is proficient in Khmer and also Thai and Japanese. So now that we have learned a little bit of Ms. Ear, she has a very extensive bio. I wanted Ms. Ear to say hello in all those languages to the world. So welcome, Ms. Ear, to our podcast.
Thank you, Manuel. Thank you, Brandon. First, good morning. It's morning in Reno.
Good morning.
In Khmer, we say Suas Day, or when you first meet somebody, you say Jimrib Sua.
Jindib Sua?
Jimrib Sua.
Oh, I like that.
And in Thai, you say Sawatika.
Sawatika. I like that.
And in Japanese, it's morning, so you say Ohayou gozaimasu.
Well, there you go.
Yes.
See, now I'm we impressed. Can leave the show. Thank you so much for coming.
And that's your global engagement.
That's right. That's right. Thank you so much, Jessica, for being here. We're so glad that you are our first guest, and you're a perfect fit for many of the reasons we just introduced you as, but just because, you know, getting to know you and you you being part of NNIC for an extensive amount of time now, we have learned so much from you, and I know that you will actually be teaching us a lot of things. So wanted the world to get to know Jess. Who's Jess? And I mean, we talked a little bit about you, but what's that we've been talking about, the human connection? So give us a little connection of you in a human way about who you are and why you do so many beautiful things.
Oh, thank you. I'm so flattered, you guys. First of all, you know, my name, you introduced me as Jessica Ear. Well, let me just admit that Jessica was not my given name by my parents.
Okay.
It was a name that I was picked for myself when we were naturalized in the fourth grade here in the U.S. My real name is Siang Huang Ear. And Siang Huang, if those in Asia are listening, Siang is the prefix to a name. All the girls in our family has it. And Siang actually means above, like Shang. Like Shanghai. Actually, okay. My sister's name is Shanghai. So my name is Xing Huang, means above the wind. Huang is cool. Wind. And ear actually means the swaying of the willow tree. So I am the wind above the swaying willow tree.
It's like a Native American name. Yes, it's like awesome. It is. That's beautiful.
Because I used to say that if you understand someone's name and someone's background is when you really understand who they are. Because we don't exist on our own. Yeah. We exist through our families, through our parents,
that's right,
through our history and our experiences in our lives who shape who we are. So, when we became American citizens, we decided to adopt English names because we are now Americans, mm-hmm, and we'll always have our heritage and our culture, but now we have a new culture and a new home, and we embrace that. My sisters all took English names as well, and that's why I'm Jessica. But it took me a while. It took me a year to respond to being called Jessica.
Right. Despite the fact that you picked that name.
Yes. Yeah. Yes. So I am a part of all of that, mm-hmm, and I think each of us have our own stories to tell. And if you understand where your history comes from, it really just makes you a stronger, better person.
Yeah.
And it helps you to direct your goal and your aim in life. And I think, that's what really influenced me, mm-hmm, to do what I did,
right,
was I grew up thinking, why did this happen to my family? Mm-hmm. Why did this happen to my country of Cambodia? And if those of you who may not be familiar, of the Indochina War, where it involved Vietnam, not just the Vietnam War, but Cambodia was a big part of that.
Right.
Cambodia was the third party that really got completely spun up, not just with the war, but with the civil war, mm-hmm, that occurred, mm-hmm, between the Pol Pot regime, which was diehard communists trying to change a country overnight,
right,
to a gregarious agricultural system, right? From what it was. So, my parents and my family being in the capital city were not just Cambodian by culture, but we came from southern China originally.
Wow.
So a lot of the southern Chinese migrated to Southeast Asia. And so we were first, second generation Cambodians, but we adopted that country.
Right.
And when the war broke out, my parents, my father, he was very astute.
Right.
And I told Manuel before that if there was ever a Hollywood script for a hero, mm-hmm, it would be my father.
That would be it.
With human flaws, but with courageous insight, mm-hmm, and no fear. Like we talked about. And my mom, who is a constant rock for him, he was like, this is not good for the country. This wave of, the communist wave was not good. And some people were like, well, no, maybe it'll be great for the country. Mm-hmm. My dad's like, no, we have to get out.
Wow.
We have to get out before it's too late. And he tried to persuade his relatives, but some people didn't listen. Mm-hmm. And, luckily, my aunt's family did listen, and they also have six kids. We have six kids in our family also. And they fled. They fled during when everything was coming down and the troops were pulling in. They walked by foot from Phnom Penh, the capital city, all the way to the Vietnamese border.
Oh,
with
gosh.
At that time, my younger sister was just born.
Right. And what year was this around?
She was born in 1975.
Okay.
So, I was born in 73, well, actually 72, but we'll get to that point later.
72, but 92, actually.
So.
Depends on what document you look at.
Yeah. So they walked to the border, and that time Vietnam was only allowing native Vietnamese to come back to the country. So they lied and said, my mom is Vietnamese. We have to get in. And they were separated at the border. She said that luckily somebody saw my dad cross the border a day or two before, because my dad had two of my siblings and my mom had two.
You were split at the border.
Yes. My dad had two, my mom had three. And my mom was wheeling, my sister who was a baby in a wheelbarrow. Mm-hmm. My dad had a bicycle.
Walking?
And we were walking sometimes in the wheelbarrow.
2 and 3 year olds.
Yeah. And we got to Vietnam and, I'm just telling a short story because it's a long story.
What's an important story? We're laying the foundation here.
Yeah. So in Vietnam in 1975 to 78, it was total anarchy.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the U.S. troops left. The southern Vietnamese capital fell. Ho Chi Minh City used to be called Saigon. So all the southern Vietnamese fled in boats at that time, the biggest exodus out of Indochina. And in the great scheme of global refugee. It was, I believe, the second wave, they call it. The first wave was from, you know, Europe with the Holocaust. So the second wave was hundreds of thousands of Southeast Asians fled in these really dinghy boats, you know. And we were in Vietnam at that time with no money, no food, no, we didn't speak Vietnamese, you know. And we went with my aunt's family, and the 12, you know, the two families stayed together, but we finally reunited with my father in Vietnam based on the fact that someone told my mom where he was.
Just pure luck.
Wow. Yeah. She, my mom to this day said we could have never seen him again at that time.
And so, where was he? Was he separated? I mean, separated from you guys, right?
Yes.
But where was he? What ended up being that?
Well, they told my mom where he was going.
Okay.
He actually, you know, my dad is very resourceful. He would like bribe if he has to border officials and stuff like that. Because
street smart.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah, yes. For sure. And when we got to Vietnam, you know, my mom sold fabric on the market, and there were police raids, and we would help like kind of her with the fabric at night. I remember sitting there like trying to singe the edges of the fabric with, you know, the candlelight and stuff. And my dad would repair watches, you know, because he had a skill to repair watches. Yeah. So he had a little watch stand. But my parents knew that we had to get out of Vietnam. There's no way we could stay.
And where
in
did you end up? You ended up after getting away. Where did you end up?
We were in a small town called My Tho, which is like outside of Ho Chi Minh City. And my parents would, you know, go to the market and try to sell things. And I, my sisters and I would take care of my two younger sisters. My mom had my youngest sister in Vietnam. She had another baby in Vietnam during that whole time. Right. So, yeah. And so we took care of my younger sisters while they're off doing their, you know, trying to make money to raise money. And we were in Vietnam for 2 years. And my dad said, we have to get out. There's no way that we could stay here.
The whole time working towards getting out.
Yes.
It was fairly dangerous still during that time period. Right. And where you were.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, we have, you know, at that time, my dad's like, there's five girls, small girls, and my brother, you know, and he was just like, there's, we have to give them a better life. And there's no way we could do that here because there wasn't even a country anymore in Vietnam, you know, after the math, when the North took over. So he didn't have any money. And people were buying passages out of Vietnam. But passages were like $1,000 a person to go on any of these, you know, rickshaw boats.
So passages were like a ticket.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah, people were buying places on these boats to get out. Right. And you know the outflux of refugees at that time. So my dad, being the resourceful, street smart guy, said, look, we don't have money to pay, but I will help you build the boat. I will get the passengers. I will, you know, he would coordinate everything.
He became a businessman. Yeah.
Yeah. So he had partners who agreed to do this. And so they secretly built a boat. And every single night he would go and talk to people about buying passages to fund the building of the boat. And in exchange, he said, we could go as a family on the boat. And
genius.
He was. Actually, when it was done, they closed the border. We couldn't get out.
Oh, no.
So then he went and, like, schmoozed the officials, bribed them if he had to give us a window of time to leave. But we didn't know when that was going to happen. But they knew he was trying to leave the country, so they were watching him, right?
Sure.
And so, you know, my dad would come home every night really late, and he was often, like, you know, drunk. And we were like, why are you out? I'm thinking as a kid, why is he partying?
Right.
Yeah. My mom just told me this last week when I visited her that my dad was out every single night cajoling with people to
convince them.
You know.
So socializing. Smooshing in a way, right?
Yeah, socializing with officials.
Right. Makes sense.
And then when they finally allowed us to leave, they said, you have 48 hours. We're going to let you. You know, and so in the middle of the night, my parents came, packed us up, you know, said, come on, we're leaving. And we escaped in the middle of the night. When we got to the port, there are all these people standing around, and they were told not to bring very much. This woman had on like 15 shirts because she couldn't bring a lot, right? We got on the boat. My dad built three engines on the boat because there are all these tales of piracies and pillage and rape and all mm-hmm. that happening at seas, drowning. He was the captain of the boat.
Oh my gosh.
He ended up being the captain of
That's
the boat.
That's crazy.
Yeah.
So how many people overall during this period of time left?
On our boat?
Well, no, just left the country.
Oh, hundreds of thousands. Why? Hundreds okay, of gotcha. Thousands. You know, but on our boat was 426.
426.
Wow, yeah. That's
it's not a small boat that he built.
No. But you know, he Jeez. Was like, there's no way we could survive if this boat wasn't built right.
Right.
And that's true. And a lot of people drowned Jeez. In the seas. They did everything they could to ensure that the boat would not sink and all that. But, you know, there were times where it took three nights, 4 days to cross to in mm-hmm. the Indochina seas. And, you know, there were times where we would look out and you see the horizon and you're wondering what's out there, right? And I remember this so well. I was just maybe 5 years old at that point. And I remember seeing boats in the horizon thinking, are we ever going to be there?
Uh-huh. Right.
We see the boats and you're like, you're wondering where they're going. You're wondering, you know, like what? Mm-hmm. What will become of us, right?
Just complete uncertainty.
Yeah. And the boat, you know, there were pirates. One night there were pirates chasing us, trying to loot the boat because they knew everyone was bringing whatever they had with them, like jewelry and stuff. And my dad was like, extinguished all the lights, turned off all the engines, you know, no cigarettes, whatever, you know. Mm-hmm. And it was pitch black. And I remember sitting there just waiting. Like, my mom was like, don't say anything. Don't, you know, be really quiet. And then it was so dark. And then he turned on all three engines and he outran them in the dark. That was the only way he could, you know, Jeez. Kind of
escape. Have a chance. Yep.
Yeah. So we got down to the border of Malaysia. Malaysia did not want to take more refugees right. in.
Sure.
So I don't know if this was actually true, but my, you know, the story my dad tells is that we were fired upon, you know, to stay away. Don't come, you know, because they were inundated by refugees.
Hundreds of thousands.
And that's what happens when you have war and famine and genocide going on. All the neighboring countries, you know, bear the burden of bringing these people in. Mm-hmm. And so the boat started sinking. You know, there was a leak.
Jeez.
Yeah. So then we were just like, what to do? And then we had actually an international ship come by and, you know, they saw we were in distress. So they took the women and children off first. And we said goodbye to my father and my brother, not knowing when we'll see them again.
Jeez, that's if.
And then we were transported to an island near Indonesia and Singapore called Pasimara. And from there, we were there for 1 month, but it was total like chaos.
Yeah.
There were no aid. You know, we had to build our own grass hut. You know, we had the tarp and everything.
Was it a camp or was it just?
It was a camp, but it wasn't an official camp. It was a camp. And there were some food rations that were coming in. Mm-hmm. You know, but my cousins would go and fish because you were on the ocean, right? Mm-hmm. So they would fish. They lived with us. I remember we all were eating dinner one night and there was a typhoon that was coming by and the tarp and the roof flew off and all the rain came down. Everyone scrambled up to pin it all down. So it was like total madness. But, yeah. You know, we look back and we're like, wow, we all pulled together, right? Because everyone was helping one another. And then after a month of there, we were transported to another camp called Tarampa. And that was where the official refugee camp was, big long houses that each family had 10 feet of that platform, you know, for their living space. And we went to school there. There were schools. Mm-hmm, there were a lot of aid workers coming in. And I remember seeing them in the camps. We'd always run to the helicopters. And, you know, they would say hello to us. And for me as a kid at that time, I was like, wow, somebody sees me.
Yeah.
Somebody sees me and knows.
Acknowledges me.
And acknowledges me. Yes. And I'm important in their eyes.
There's a bigger system that cares.
And that left such an impression on me.
Well, let me just ask you, you know, you've been talking about your life and your how you got to where you are today, in essence. But, I mean, you're really describing the stories that many of our family, refugee families, have had. And some of them have gone through worse, obviously. But it's just so dynamic and amazing. And we were talking, and you and I have similarities in the sense that, you know, my dad brought me here too, and he was just my hero, and continues to be. today, but just it's just so amazing how your parents loved you so much and loved all your siblings. I mean, and saw, hey, we need to get out of here. This is not the best place to be at. And he saw the urgency. And not only that, he was very, creative. He knew how to work out, you know, the scenario and make the best out of it. And in your eyes, it was like, you know, when he would come, like you mentioned, would come drunk or something, he was actually working his butt off, right? Yes. To really make, you know, get you guys out of there.
Yes.
So this is so amazing.
I didn't know that until this week.
Right.
I honestly did not know that when my mom retold the story. And, and you know, we were always very blessed, mm-hmm. I think, because on mm-hmm. our boat, instead of anyone dying, we actually had one live birth.
Oh my gosh.
427 passengers.
Jeez, that's so cool.
And yeah, so that was kind of an omen that, you know,
there was hope.
There was hope.
Yeah.
Yes.
That's really cool.
And, you know, and in the refugee camps, again, he went drinking with the politicians there, right. The officials there. We have pictures of him with Indonesians. He doesn't speak any Indonesians, no. But he spoke, you know, the human language, mm-hmm. that human connection that we're talking
correct.
About.
Yeah, that's so cool.
And it's so important because right. you don't have to speak the language to communicate. Mm-hmm. You know, he went hunting with them. You know, right. he brought back snakes. He brought back, animals that they hunted. And that was my protein food for our family. Right. You know, I ate snake soup. I ate, you know, horseshoe crab. We uh-huh. ate, you know.
That sounds really tasty right now.
Yeah, monkey brains, you know.
Wow,
so
that's crazy.
Was just the delicacy, that kind
right,
of thing. So
right.
my dad did all that because of his ability to connect with people.
Right. Well, let's talk about that really fast because, you know, That's what we learned from our families, that they're very creative. They're very obviously heroes in their own way. And now, once you made it, to the camp and you moved away from there, what period of time did you move away and where did you go to after the camp?
So we were in the camps for 2 years.
2 years.
And
okay.
every year there was at that time, countries were taking in refugees, mm-hmm. and Germany was taking in, you know, Australia, Canada, Japan. And you can put your name on the list of the countries you okay. want to go to. And my dad and my mom strongly felt that we had to come to the U.S. because they always say, well, in Asia, you know, girls don't have a lot of opportunities. It's just very unfortunate. And the fact that they have five girls, they said, we need to go to a country that would give us the most opportunities for our girls. Mm-hmm. My mom was like, my girls need the opportunity to go to school. They need to, and the U.S., we have such a legacy of being like this wonderful, welcoming country. Mm-hmm. Our history is all about, you know, immigrants, and mm-hmm. our values and our what makes us American is that mm-hmm. we are champions of democracy. And not only that, but human rights.
Yeah.
You know, we value human rights. We value freedom and liberty. And we embrace that. So my mom's like, we're not going to Germany. The history with Germany
oh,
was
right.
not good.
Exactly.
You know, and Japan is so homogeneous that it's a little difficult to integrate. Canada was wonderful too, but my mom held out 2 years in the refugee camps when we could have gone somewhere else.
Sooner. Really?
Yeah, sooner.
Wow.
But when our names were called, oh, it was a joyous day. I remember people running to school when we were in school and pulling us out of school. We had a big party to leave. And we unfortunately had to leave my aunt's family behind.
Oh, no.
That my aunt's family who came with us to Vietnam and through all the journey. And, they stayed longer. And it took them so long to have their names to come to the U.S. that they ended up going to Canada.
Right.
So if you... Those of you who don't know much about refugee statistics, right now in this world, we have the highest amount of displaced people ever recorded, ever,
right.
because
right.
of the war in Ukraine and Afghanistan and elsewhere.
And environmental changes, all that
yes.
stuff. Yes.
Out of that 100, mm-hmm. close to 100 displaced people, 35 million are true refugees who are fleeing conflict and persecution and war. And out of 35 million... Last year, only 113,000 people were resettled to another country. So it really is the last option for our refugees.
Right.
And that's like 1/3 of 1% of the 35 million.
Right.
So it really is a lottery system,
right.
how I described it back then. It's not like that now. But we really scored, right. so to speak.
Well, of course.
When our names came up for the U.S.
And so many people throughout the world going through all these chaotic moments in their life, you know, some of them choose to stay in their country, you know, and it's amazing whether it's a war, whether it's, I mean, we've seen it happen. It's like they just obviously love their country, they don't want to go somewhere else. They want
to
be there.
Nobody wants to go somewhere else. They love where they are. And, you know, some people are fortunate to return when the situation gets better. Some people gets integrated where they are, like in the neighboring countries. And then some people, there's no option but to resettle and start anew somewhere. And those are the three, what they call refugee solutions, durable solutions, right? Repatriation, reintegration, resettlement.
Well, you know, I was saying, you know, thinking, you know, I'm an immigrant from Mexico, came here when I was 11 years old, crossed the border, et cetera. But I think, you know, in essence, we're all refugees. I think, you know, we're fleeing for a better world, for a better opportunity to really see that... you know, that horizon that you were describing earlier. We see it in our minds, but we actually want to see it in person, and to actually see that and really get to that point is just a beautiful thing once we're here.
Yeah. And another moment I remember was on our way to the U.S. We went via Hong Kong for one night, and we were put up in the, I guess it was the Y or something similar.
Okay.
And I looked out the window, and if you've ever been to Hong Kong at night, it's just spectacular cityscape. And I just remember thinking again, the same feeling I had when I looked out the porthole and saw the horizon and the distant boat was, you know, where are we going?
Yeah.
Where are all these cars going? These beautiful, colorful lives that these people are living.
Right.
And I wanted that for us.
Right.
You know, I remember yearning for that.
Right.
And it was one of those moments that really touches you at the very, very bottom of your heart.
Yeah.
And that, I think, is that human connection that we have. It's like everyone wants that.
Everyone wants that.
Everyone wants that. Everyone wants their kids to do well, to succeed, to have babies, to hold babies, you know, opportunities. And to be able to see that for a parent, and parents will do anything to see that.
Yep. As both your guys' parents demonstrate.
Yeah.
Yeah. Now that's amazing because, you know, it seems like along the way, along your journey, you were seeing these little hints of your life developing as you were, you know, going through all these changes and in your history. But it's like you were seeing those horizons, those lights, that hope was always there.
Yes.
And I think, I mean, obviously, I'm sure you attribute that to your parents, you know, struggle and ingenuity and everything they had to go through. But it's just so amazing that you were seeing signs of hope, of faith, of just keep it together, keep it strong.
Yeah.
And I think it really...
And you know what's really funny? I mean, I don't mind sharing my age. I just turned 50 recently.
Okay.
And thank
That's
you.
Awesome.
And I'm finding out that hope, that light is in all of us and everybody you meet. And once you are able to tap into that, they're like family to you.
Right.
You might as well consider them family because that's how strong that bond is. And that's how true someone is. You know, so I was just telling Brandon when we were chatting earlier that every time I meet somebody now, I really go straight for that light, that core that makes you who you are. And, you know, that makes... you know, that person, the essence of that person. Because everything else is just, you know, fluff, right? It doesn't matter. People cover it up and stuff. But really, if you can touch people there is when you truly have a friend, you truly have a brother or a sister.
Right. Mm-hmm. Well, this is a beautiful, beautiful moment, Jess, to actually take a break. So we give everyone the opportunity to really hear your words, the light, the hope, and everything you've been talking about so they can process it. And what a great way, because we actually have a segment here called Mindfulness Moment with Dr. Yvonne Stedham. So let's take a quick break. And we'll, when we come back, I want to ask you questions about your, the reason why you joined the NNIC board. And obviously, we kind of all know why. You have a great connection with our organization in many ways, and that human connection really is beaming out of you. So thank you so much for being here. Ladies and gentlemen, we're going to go to our segment, Mindfulness Moment with Dr. Yvonne Stedham. Please keep it here. This is Diplo Chats. And now, mindfulness moment with Dr. Yvonne Stedham on DiploChats.
Today's episode addresses the first foundation of mindfulness, mindfulness of the body. This includes mindfulness of breathing, body posture, and physical characteristics. Mindfulness is about being in the present moment and paying attention without judgment. It makes sense that the first foundation of mindfulness is the body. The body can only be in the present moment. You cannot be in a future or a past breath. Also, noticing breathing lets you realize that breathing just happens. There's nothing you need to do. You can simply observe whether your breathing is shallow or deep, long or short, without any evaluation of good or bad. Bringing attention to body postures also helps us to be firmly rooted in the present moment. Throughout a day, we continuously transition from sitting to standing to walking and to lying down. When you change postures, it is useful to explore the intention for and the consequences of the change. Posture also reflects a person's state of mind. We can easily see whether a person is at ease or stressed just by their body posture. Finally, mindfulness of physical characteristics points to the fact that the basic components of the body are the same for all people. Through being mindful of physical characteristics, we see the changing nature of the body. From the moment we are born, it changes. We cannot control that, and we suffer when we try to do so. Overly identifying with one's physical appearance makes life difficult. Mindfulness allows us to see when we are doing that and gives us an opportunity to change our thinking. As you go through your day, I encourage you to pay attention to the body, the breath, and the postures you are in, and to pay attention to how you relate to the physical characteristics of your and others' bodies. This is Dr. Yvonne. Have a mindful day. Hi, this is Dr. Yvonne Stedham. You are listening to Diplo Chats. Tune in to next month's Mindfulness Moment segment on mindfulness of feelings. Make sure to download Diplo Chats wherever you get your podcasts. Have a mindful day.
Ladies and gentlemen, we're back with Diplo Chats. I'm Manuel Mederos here with you. Diplo Chats, where your global engagement begins with a chat. Speaking about chat, we've been actually having a very amazing conversation with Miss Jessica Ear. If you have not heard about her yet, rewind. Start the Diplo Chats episode one at the very beginning of the conversation with Miss Jess Ear, and you'll be listening to her bio and such an amazing conversation about her challenges that she had crossing many countries to make it to new worlds and seeing those horizons and lights that really have put the path of hope and faith and all that you want to say about that. But it's been a really amazing conversation. Mm-hmm. And Brandon, you had a conversation that actually will take us to our next questions with her. So go ahead and ask your question.
Please. So one thing that I can't help but notice from your story, but also from the story of so many of our refugee families who have gone through the process of resettlement, is just the massive gap that exists between that moment of need when your family is displaced, when your country becomes no longer tenable, and the moment when you actually get access to this global system that can get you into resettlement services or can get you into repatriation services. And there's just this massive, there seems to be this massive gap between the moment when you have the need to be helped and when your family is vulnerable and the amount of time that it actually takes to get into any sort of those services. I think that from the U.S. perspective that I was raised with, there's a lot of assumptions that are made about people who get displaced and immigrants who have to go into resettlement services, who have to use maybe illegal or unofficial means to cross borders, things like that. I wonder if you can speak on that perspective and why there is this massive gap between people who need help, people who are seeking services, and the amount of time or the amount of struggle they have to go through to receive those services. Maybe that inspired a little bit of what became your career.
Yes. You know, it's funny you should bring that up because a lot of times when in war-torn conflict situations, you can't have humanitarians there all necessarily because it's dangerous. Sure. But those who get there, who are able to provide resources, risk their lives mm-hmm. to do it. And every year, UNHCR and other aid workers, you know, make that sacrifice. Mm-hmm. And that's why I think, you know, the Red Cross is so adamant about protecting the symbol of the Red Cross for humanitarians, right. Because humanitarians should be neutral. And they stand by that firmly for that reason, because of access. Access to be able to help people no matter who they are in need. But now that line's been blurred a bit, you know, so the risk is there for sure. So they have these centers where they know they try to make it safe for people to go to. And those who are fleeing would tell each other, go here. You know, like my relatives went to the refugee camps in the border of Thailand, you know, in Khao Idang. My grandmother passed away in that Khao Idang camp, you know, and when I was working in Thailand, I was working as a diplomat, but with the in charge of the refugee resettlement program out of Thailand. So 25 years later, mm-hmm. when, you know, I'm back in where I started mm-hmm. helping the program that brought my family to the U.S. and, you know, meeting people who've been working there for years, and not everybody makes it out, mm-hmm. you know, unfortunately, mm-hmm. people die along the way, you know, people starve. People, you know, die of illnesses. Right. So it's not an easy plight at
decision
all.
Decision, too.
No.
Right?
No. And those, when you get to those services centers, you're lucky.
Right.
A lot of people don't make it.
Right.
You know, so they help each other along right. the way. They're like, get here. This is where you can right. get food, water, shelter. And, you know, it's, so that is a problem. But, you know, the International Committee of the Red Cross, as well as the International Federation of the Red Cross, two very different organizations under one symbol.
Interesting.
Yes. IFRC works with humanitarian aid and support. And International Committee of the Red Cross really works with, you know, more of the legal cases and sure. more of the policies. But they do also... protection of the neutrality of the Red Cross.
Okay.
So that's so people can get there to provide aid. Mm. And that's why they claim the neutrality so strongly, because it equates to access.
Right. I mean, we were talking earlier about, to Brendan's question a bit, is a lot of people, like we talked earlier, they don't really want to leave their country. I mean, they love their country so much, and many of them get to a new place and they're extremely humble to even ask for those services, because obviously their upbringing, etc. But you know, and some of them might not know where to access those services, and they might not want to ask because they might think they might get in trouble or something to that degree. What would you say is kind of the point where a family kind of breaks away from that and says, you know, I really do need the help. I need to access the services. This is better, the betterment for the family, et cetera. Like what, at what point do you think people reach that?
This is before they, in the camps or after?
Either the camps or when they come to the country, to their new country.
My father is very proud. Mm-hmm. He's a very proud man. My mom is a very proud woman. They would do everything they can in their power to provide for themselves and their family. When we came to the U.S., we had nothing. And we were sponsored by a Presbyterian church out of Vienna, Virginia.
Yes.
And we had a sponsorship family, first Mr. and Mrs. Anderson, and then Mr. and Mrs. Higgins, who became part of our family. We were on food stamps for 2 years, you know, and I had the food lunch punch cards, you know. Mm-hmm. We accepted clothes from our church and housing for our church. But 3 days after we landed, my parents went to work, because that's the essence of, you know, teach a man how to fish.
Absolutely.
Don't give him the fish, you
right,
know.
Exactly.
And this is the concept of that. My dad believes that.
We heard that. I mean, he actually did that.
Yeah. So we accepted food stamps because we needed it.
Right.
The social services, the network, we need that for people to get started, because there are times in our lives where we can't help ourselves completely and you have to seek others to help you.
Absolutely.
And no matter how humble you are, no matter how strong and brave you are, you always need human help, a friend's help. And at this point in our lives, it was the church.
Right.
You know? And they found my dad a job as a watch repairs person at a jewelry business in Tyson's Corner, Virginia. And then he said he needed to make more money. So he wanted to moonlight as his friend told him about this dishwashing job at the Marriott, or was in the Marriott, another hotel there. But he did that for a week, but he didn't sleep.
Wow.
He worked as a watch repairsman during the day. At night, he was doing dishes. And my mom's like, you can't continue. And he's like, how am I going to feed my family? Because the assistance we give refugees, as you know, is very nominal.
Right.
And it's only for a few months.
Right.
And my dad's like, we're getting off food stamps as soon as we can afford to. But we accepted food stamps. Right. And that's nothing to be ashamed of.
Right.
And we're so blessed and lucky that we had those services to support us, and those people, the families who took us in, and the church pretty much like adopted us. We had like six little kids, you know. I remember being presented at church and you know, we're all wearing our, you know, clothes that they gave us. Uh-huh. And we didn't understand a word, you know, because we didn't speak any English. But it turns out, like, I went to school with a girl who donated her clothes, and I was wearing her clothes. And I didn't know that, and I was rather embarrassed. But she never made me feel ashamed of the fact that I was wearing her dress. You know, I still remember her name to this day. Linda Cohen, wherever you are, thank you.
Linda, thank you, Linda.
Yeah, so, you know, families like that who cared enough to show the humanity.
Right.
And we remember that. We remember their names. We remember what they did.
You know, you're talking something very important, because we here at Northern Nevada International Center, we have amazing volunteers, amazing community members and donors, and obviously our staff that just pour love for all these families. And obviously they deserve that and more. But it's just so amazing that we all work together. We're all connected in a human way to make their lives easier or a bit, nicer in a way, because they've been through so much. And you were talking about their dependency on things, and really one thing that they do, I mean, our families do it on their own. They don't want to be, depending on something. They want to be independent. They want to be away from, you know, depending on the food stamps and everything. And they really don't stay in those systems for a long time.
No.
And people think out there, they have a perception that, immigrants and all these refugees take advantage of the system. You know, they really don't. They actually contribute back. They're part of the fabric of this country. They contribute back as business owners.
Oh, yes.
I think
as
it's people, one of the best investments our society can make.
I think so.
I always say that, like, you know, when the church helped my family, they didn't just help eight people. They helped hundreds.
Right.
Because my dad was able to help his family and his relatives and his nieces and nephews. And now they're having kids and they have businesses. They're employee people. You know, my one cousin joined the Marines. My sister went into humanitarian work, you know.
You became a diplomat.
I became a diplomat. Yeah. And my sole thing was, I was really moved by the aid workers in the camp. And I was really moved by a few experiences that happened in my parents' lives, you know. Mm-hmm. Well, to go back to that, these moments contribute to who we are.
I was wondering about that. You get connected with everything you did.
Yeah. So my mom cleaned hotel rooms with my sister. That was the Econo Lodge. My dad worked as a jewelry and watch repairs person. But he said, we cannot feed six kids with these salaries,
Exactly.
you know? And so he started doing what he did best, which was jewelry. He knew how to make things. He knew how to teach himself how to make things. Right. And they started saving money, and they bought some gold, and they said, you know, we're going to make some necklaces and sell it to the people met through his work.
He's a total businessman, your dad.
He's like, we have to find a way.
Yeah,
we have to find a way. And he's like, we have to work for ourselves. There's no way we could send these kids to school and to feed them and everything else.
Yeah,
you know, I just can't imagine what, you know, as a child, you take advantage of the fact that your parents would take care of you because they always showed that strong front. As a mom now, I feel like, gosh, I don't know how my parents did that. Mm-hmm. Six kids all under the age of 16, no English.
Yeah.
No skills, no education. You know, my mom didn't go to school. She didn't know how to read and write. She taught herself what she knows.
So, Jess, we have a few more minutes left here with you. And you're actually part of the Northern Nevada International Board of Directors. And why? Please tell me, why did you want to be part of it?
You know, I was working with the State Department. Then I went to work for the Department of Defense. And I was in Hawaii. And then I had my kids. And we actually thought we'd take a couple of years off to just travel the country. And we wanted to buy an RV and do that. And 2019, we did that. We sold our house in Hawaii and did that. And I said, okay, 2 years. I'll step away from my job for 2 years. Right. Well, guess what happened in 2020, right?
Yeah, exactly.
The pandemic hit. And so we just kept going. And it ended up being a four-year adventure. And we have a little YouTube channel to kind of track it. And just for fun, if you're interested, it's called John Jess Journey. And I'll promote this with that also. It's kind of inactive now. But we ended up in Reno because there were so many great places to settle down. We didn't know where, but we have a really good friend who lives here.
Yeah.
And we just said, let's give it a shot. And when I sent my kids to school, but then I said, you know, I really want to go back to doing something that really means something to me. And my husband always said, you know, when you did refugee resettlement from the State Department, it was the most fulfilling thing you've ever done.
That's cool.
And I said, it's true. That's everything I've ever done, even though I've loved working with the military, it always goes back to my heart and what really touches me. Right. And so I Googled. I had no idea. I Googled International Refugee Resettlement Northern Nevada, and you guys came up.
Da-dun.
Yeah, it's the only organization in Northern Nevada to do this. And I read about Karina. And I was really didn't know what to do.
Yeah.
You know, I wanted to volunteer, but I didn't know how. I was trying to, maybe I should reach the volunteer coordinator.
Right.
But I talked
Amanda.
To her. Yeah, Amanda. And I was going to do that. But then my friend said, email Dr. Black. Mm-hmm. Directly, because you have the expertise to help them. Yeah. Don't sell yourself short.
Right.
And I did. I emailed Karina and we had an hour-long conversation and I was just, what can I do to help, you know, and what can I do to volunteer? And I said, you know, I could drive people around. I could do all these things that the volunteers do as well. And I said, but these are my experiences.
Right.
And she started keeping me in the loop about some of the clients' cases.
Yeah.
But then, you know, a few months ago, she said, are you interested in joining the board? That's and cool. I said, if it helps the organization to grow and to do things more effectively, to help people, then yes, I would love to.
Well, we need people like you that have gone through many of the experiences that our families have gone through. I mean, those are the best advocates. People that love our families, like Brandon and Dina and all these amazing staff and Karina. But it's just the connection that we all have with each other. But it's just, I mean, you went through a lot of, being a refugee yourself. I mean, you understand of their struggles. Yeah, from both sides, exactly. Of the success and also what got you to this point.
And did you know, Manuel, you probably know this because English is not your first language. Spanish is.
Oh, you noticed? Thanks.
Right? Yes. So English is my third language. When we were kids and we were hearing all the aid workers speak English, we kind of imitated them and walked around and pretend we spoke English.
That's cool.
And native English speakers don't know this, but the English language, all you hear are S's. Right? So all you hear are the s at the end.
Yeah.
So my sisters and I would walk around going, and we're awesome. Pretending we're speaking English. That's so cool. Yeah, it's kind of funny. English as a language, you know, I remember learning all how complicated everything. I'm like, why is there two knights, knights? Yeah. You know,
knights.
Or oh, how come deer?
Read, read.
How come we don't say deer, deers?
Yeah, yeah.
You know,
three.
Yeah. Very strange. Yeah.
Well, Jess, we have come to the end of our show, and I just wanted to. We're so blessed to have you part of NNIC, and you are really. Mimic what we essentially do in the community. I mean, you're who NNIC is, essentially. Absolutely. And the human connection that you talked about was so essential and really kicks off our season. So I'm just so thrilled that you actually made it here. And I'm so happy and blessed that you were here with us today. So thank you for coming on Diplo Chats. And we'll bring you back. So Hakuna Matata. So we'll bring you back, and it will be awesome to have you here again and talk
to
us.
Thank you so much.
Thank you, you both. So I'll just say, Okuntran, Kapkun Ka, Arigato Gozaimasu, and in Vietnamese, Cảm ơn you.
I know you said, Manuel is beautiful. Thank you so much.
All right. Gracias.
Nada. Okay, ladies and gentlemen, thank you so much for listening to Diplo Chats. But we're going to come back in just a moment with our Diplo Wrap. And we'll, me and Brandon will have a little conversation, and then we'll end our show. But thank you, Miss Jessica Ear, Jess Ear, for being here on Diplo Chats. We're so blessed and thankful that you made it to us and you were here. This is Diplo Chats, ladies and gentlemen. We'll be right back with Diplo Rap.
Are you looking for ways to make an impact in the local community? Here at Northern Nevada International Center, we get to work with some of the most incredible youth from all over the world who have come here as refugees, and we invite you to become part of their story as one of our mentors. The Refugee Youth Mentor Program is an awesome opportunity to make a difference in the life of a young person learning to live in a new place. As a mentor, you will help refugee youth learn valuable skills for navigating American society, as well as helping them become more connected with the local community. With your help, we can make Reno into their new home. If you are interested or have further questions, email Aaron Layden, alayden@nnic.org. That is alayden@nnic.org.
All I have to say is wow.
Wow, wow.
This
wow.
show is a great kickoff to our season number two. Número dos, and I'm just so thankful that you're here, Brandon, and you're actually going to come back.
Oh, yeah.
And do this again, you Absolutely. Lucky dog. But I'm so happy that you made it here. Really quickly, Brandon, what was your takeaway from today's show?
Well, first of all, I'm just so happy, and I feel so lucky to have people like Jessica in our community
yep.
that are representing Agreed. Not only the refugee experience, but just the amazing experience of Northern Nevadans. As yeah. No matter how long they've been here, we have people that just arrived to Reno or that have lived here their whole lives that have been working in the international community and that can bring this global perspective to Northern Nevada that I am so happy to have here. This is something, as somebody who grew up here, I feel so lucky, and I feel like our region especially is becoming so much more dynamic and expanding. And right. I think Jessica, you're like a perfect example of that, of
I
people
agree.
Who are living here or creating lives here that are going to only expand our global connection
right.
From right here in Reno. And it's very, very exciting to me.
I agree with you. And one thing, I mean, many things I took away from it, but it's just, you know, as Jessica was talking, she really reminded me of where I came from and what I went through to get here and where I am today. And the success that we all have and you know, we were meant to be here,
Absolutely.
You know, and I think there's a place for all of us and this planet and this country. And I'm so thankful that we're still a country that welcomes refugees. And there's so many people that love refugees, that love immigrants and that are so welcoming to them. And I think they deserve that and more. And I'm just so blessed to be part of this community and this country because hearing her conversation with us about the light, and I just keep going to that light and that horizon and those things that she mentioned was very inspirational mm-hmm. because, you know, those are things that I'm starting to really, when I'm getting to know people and especially strangers mm-hmm. and if you haven't heard our past season one, we talked about how to meet strangers and not being afraid from people who are different, who speak differently than you and look different. And it's okay to to touch their lives and be part of their lives and help them out. Because when we help them out, we help our society become better and thrive. So, and also Dr. Von Stedham talked about posture and breathing techniques and everything like that. So it was just such an amazing episode today. Episode one kicks us everything. We actually, this show lasted more than an hour, which has never happened before. That means we talk a lot, Brandon.
Oh my gosh.
And that's not a good thing.
I can't wait to do it again.
I know. Yeah, exactly. Well, ladies and gentlemen, thank you so much for being part of DiploChats episode one. I'm glad you made it home. This is your home. Northern Nevada International Center welcomes you here anytime. Please learn about our organization, NNIC.org. That is NNIC.org. If you have any feedback about how we can improve our show, DiploChats, DiploChats@NNIC.org, DiploChats@NNIC.org. And please do not forget to download, like, subscribe to our podcast wherever you are and wherever you hear our podcast. I'm so thankful and blessed that you made it to DiploChats today. And remember, DiploChats, where your global engagement begins with a chat. We'll see you on episode two. Thank you so much for listening.